Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Ben Stover, and I'm joined by
Hannah Espinoza-Rimas. I'm a marriage and family therapist.
Brittany Brownfield. I'm a child therapist.
We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, aka therapists, and we practice out of the Ardent Center in Chicago. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. And today, we have selected Batman Begins. So in this movie, this is the start of the Batman ethos in the Dark Knight trilogy. We're going to be talking about trauma, PTSD, and survivor's guilt. We're going to be talking about identity, and we're going to be talking about what treatment we might want to do. And we're probably going to center that directly on Bruce Wayne for this episode.
Yeah, I feel like this whole episode is going to be entirely just about Batman. But Batman just in this movie. Not even Batman in the whole Dark Knight trilogy. Just right. This movie in a vacuum.
Right. It'll probably be this movie. There will probably be some things that slip out of my mouth because I know a lot about Batman, but I'm going to try to contain it to this movie because Batman has so many alternate universes that we're going to try to narrow it to just this film.
There's the Michael Keaton Batman, which is very different, a.k.a. turtlenecks, from the Val Kilmer Batman, which was my favorite as a child.
Yeah, same.
I thought he was super sexy.
Yeah.
And then George Clooney's Batman.
We don't speak of R.I.P.
nipple costume.
we don't speak of that one.
No, yeah.
So, I mean, because I think this movie does also the best job of showing a full story of someone with very obvious PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Which
is the first
thing we're going to get into, which is, I mean, everyone who's seen it. Well, everyone who's seen any Batman movie, even the newer ones like with Ben Affleck. There's the classic story. I like him. I mean, it was a good montage. But it's the scene where he's with his parents and they get shot in front of him by
Joe Chill.
That's what a name. Which I don't think I realized or remember until I saw this movie.
You know, there's a lot of characters and cameos they snuck in there who are like great Batman villains that they just kind of threw in there. Like Joe Chill is the one who shoots his dad. Sometimes it's the Joker. Sometimes the Joker is Joe Chill.
Yeah, we looked it up because we actually were talking about that while we watched the movie.
We were straight up arguing that I did not think the Joker killed his parents in any version of the movies,
and I told her she was wrong, and I was right.
Yep. In the Michael Keaton one, it's Joker.
Gotcha. Yeah, so basically, we're already going off the rails, guys.
Sorry.
So basically, there's this kid, rich kid, Bruce Wayne. His parents get shot and murdered straight up in front of his ass, and then
he's 8 or 9.
He's probably like between 8 and 10 years old, depending on. I know the show Gotham. He's like 11 or 12, a little bit older. But basically, that's like the classic Bruce Wayne origin story.
Yeah.
Right.
That classic slow shot of his parents being shot, pearls.
And the pearl necklace
is going everywhere.
Right, which they recreated in Batman versus Superman for no reason.
Yep.
All right, let's relax. So, well, we see the first sign of PTSD clearly in Bruce Wayne is that memory is a recurrent flashback he has throughout the whole movie.
Well, the first one we see with him is the falling into the well.
True, that falling into well
opens with that,
bats everywhere,
right?
And then so that ends the flashbacks of that, and it seems like he has nightmares.
Yep,
that are of these nightmares. are of these memories. So flashback nightmares of these memories.
I think he also has regular flashbacks during the day as well.
Well, he seems like when anything happens that triggers him, he'll have a flashback.
Yeah, he dissociates into those memories for sure.
Yeah.
And, I mean, flashback's pretty cut and dry what that means. It literally is like a flashing back to a memory. It kind of, how it's portrayed in movies is like a flashbulb moment.
Right, it takes you back to that moment and you're reliving it again. It's not just that you see it again. It's like you're back there every time.
Which is the same thing every time. Yeah, which is realistic to how real people experience flashbacks, is you do feel like you are back in it. It's not just that you're remembering it, and that's troubling. But some people will smell the smells of when that memory was. They'll feel like if it was cold, they'll feel cold. Like they'll hear the things that happened at that time. Like it's not just like something occurring to you again. It's like immersive.
Yeah. It's like your body is remembering. So all the parts of your body where you said were like, if it's cold, your body feels physically cold. It's all those parts are all linked. Mm-hmm. It's not just the memory.
Right. And if you're curious about that phenomenon. There's actually a fantastic book that I recommend everybody, provider or not, just to understand, because almost everyone in the world is going to have some kind of trauma at some time, but there's a fantastic book about that called The Body Keeps the Score.
Oh.
I have heard of that book.
It's
from someone else.
It's a really good book about trauma and how the brain and the body will store the memory and the images and how you can re-experience it. And it's very, very enlightening to understand, like, the way that trauma becomes this immersive experience like we're talking about here. And it's not just a memory that plays over and over. It's a whole body experience.
And that's why senses can trigger a flashback as well. Like, if you smell a smell that was similar to your trauma experience, if you see something, you feel something, that can all lead to flashbacks. And he's living in his parents' house, so I'm sure there's tons of smells that remind him of his parents. His family is rich and famous in this town, Gotham, so he sees their names everywhere. So that's probably triggering as well.
Everywhere. And then, mm-hmm. We've even talked about this when we did our 50 Shades podcast, like the same thing with the body. Like, Christian has that, he like lipsticks off like parts of his chest that she mm-hmm. can't touch. So mm-hmm. there's evidence all over the place of how this trauma could be stored in the body, and then how it could be triggered by other things, like Brittany's saying, with seeing your family name or smells or seeing pictures, or if he saw a woman that looked like his mom with like the short haircut and like a black dress with pearl necklace mm-hmm. on, like all those things could mm-hmm. be triggering moments.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of this in the moment now, but it also makes me wonder if that's why when he's like in his 20s, when he goes home to Wayne Manor, he's like, I would tear this house down brick by brick if I could. You know, that, I mean, it might be because it's maybe just really hard to be there. And like, just where he lived and grew up.
Maybe he's having a trauma response every time he comes home.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure he is. And then you have to like think about like, it became his house when he's 10 years old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. That was all he came home to.
I mean,
every time he's going to remember that same day where he came home.
To a palace. I mean, okay.
But it's still sad.
It's still sad. Like, he's not going to know any different. Calm down there, Sparky. God.
Sorry.
And so other symptoms of PTSD is hypervigilance, which we've talked about before, which is when you're kind of on guard all the time. You're jumpy. You're kind of like looking for threats at all times, which, I mean, he kind of, that's part of his Batman persona. I mean, he is a vigilante. And so I wonder how much of that was something he was already doing or a part of himself because of his PTSD that he like reframed as a positive, quote unquote positive, you know what I mean? Like as a tool he's utilizing instead of just something that's probably keeping him edgy all the time.
Right. I mean, it's his response to that hypervigilance, but he's going out actively seeking
mm-hmm.
the situations that produced his trauma.
Yeah. Re-traumatizing himself because he's putting himself in front of bad guys with guns and stuff. Very similar to, you know, when he was a kid, which you could also say is that part of trying to assert control back over of a situation in which he was traumatized and he was very out of control because he was a child and he couldn't do anything, you know, to protect his parents. So I wonder if part of it is to like trying to reclaim his narrative, his story by going into similar settings and then being the hero this time.
I'm sure that's exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. When you look at Batman's entire psychology, it's revolving around that trauma moment. Like the entire time his entire response to dealing with his trauma is to make criminals afraid of the things that he was afraid of. He mm-hmm. even talks about this in a movie, like, why bats? Bats frighten me. I want to share that fear with them. And I think that he doesn't overtly say it, but when he's talking about like, or when he's so driven to become this physically trained to the peak of human condition fighter that he's now going to go out and beat these criminals down who cause fear.
Which is something you see a lot. No, I shouldn't say a lot. I shouldn't generalize like that. But you can see frequently sometimes in people that have been traumatized is wanting to assert control in a certain way, like going to self-defense classes, you know, or just becoming very aggressive because you want to assert control. Or like when we talk about kids who have been abused and they become the abuser. Part of that isn't because like they're choosing to be like the thing that they hated as a kid, but part of it is because then they feel in control because now they're the one who's scary and they're the one who is dominating, and so that you can't get dominated when you're dominating. So it's also that part of it. And that's where, I mean, that's where it gets like real, the dark negative version of it, which, I mean, Batman, you could argue he's becoming, yeah, like you said, he's becoming the scary thing so that he's no longer scared.
Right. And you see it with him, other trauma symptoms that start to exist is he goes through a couple of them. Like when you're seeing younger Bruce Wayne, when he's coming back from college and when he's going to the trial to go shoot Joe Chill, like you see he's clearly depressed.
Yeah, he's definitely like he's failing out of school.
Right, he's withdrawn. He's very clearly withdrawn.
He's not,
doesn't make a lot of eye contact.
He's not sociable. He talks
to. No.
Like it doesn't seem like he has any friends. And of a person of his status, you think he'd be like have a lot of friends at school.
Oh yeah.
Or at least like it seems like the only person he really knows is friend wise is Rachel. And they're not close.
No, they haven't been close since they were kids. Like ever since, like they did make a point to show the scene of like where the house workers, which Rachel's mom is and why Rachel's even there, they no longer have a job, and they show them packing up their car and leaving just to like further isolate Bruce.
He is a very, what we call in the business, blunted affect, which affect is how your feelings are presenting on your face, and blunted is how it sounds, where you don't really have a lot of emotional range in your face. Like he doesn't really smile unless he's putting on the act of Bruce Wayne. You know, he just kind of looks stoic at best.
Right. I mean, he's approaching the point of what we'd call flat, where they don't show emotional reaction to just about anything. They stay
someone blank. when you're talking to them, there's just no light.
The most affect he has is with Alfred.
Yeah.
Oh, my main bae in this movie, Alfred. Yes. Like, he does joke with Alfred more than once. He will smile when Alfred makes jokes. Like, he is more jokey with Alfred. Like, when Alfred tries to wake him up he's like, I'm a bachelor nocturnal. Like, he only really cracks jokes around Alfred. But other than that, he's very blunted.
And I think Christian Bale does a good job of also being physically relaxed when he's around Alfred versus when he's around other people. Like, he's physically, his body.
He slouches and
like
stuff.
Like, his body is more relaxed when he's around Alfred than anybody else in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really seem to have, I want to say normal interests, like hobbies. Like, he is very, he doesn't really live a normal life by his own choice. But he doesn't really have interest in what you could consider healthy and appropriate things.
No, his interests are all geared towards his obsession with fighting. I mean, he gets deep into martial arts and survival and computers, but it's all around being a detective.
Well, you could also argue
all around being in control.
I was going to say, it's also kind of all about, you could all say it's all motivated by his hypervigilance. You know, his feelings of wanting to be in control, or to be protected and be safe is, I'm going to learn everything about everything. I'm going to use all my family resources to, you know, learn about stuff and to be the best version of whatever, Batman.
Right. And this movie doesn't represent him the same way that many of the other iterations do, where he's like represented as like super hyper intelligent and like the best detective in the world.
Well,
I mean, this is where he's starting, but I don't feel like this series ever represents him quite like that.
Well, he's not a playboy. Like in the other movies, he's way more of a playboy. I know he kind of puts on a playboy demeanor when he's pretending to be Bruce Wayne.
Right.
When he's
never
being like,
buy it, though.
But like the Michael Keaton version of Bruce Wayne was very like swaggery.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
On and off the clock. Like, he was turtlenecking it up, hitting on ladies.
So many turtlenecks.
And then Val Kilmer, too. Like, I mean, they were kind of like the superhero version of James Bond. Like, every movie, a different hot lady.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that up with. And so, and it didn't seem like that was an act that he was turning on and off.
I mean, Batman is the American James Bond, if you think about it. He basically is.
I mean, orphan, a lot of resources, and very reckless, and banging
has
ladies.
Has a lot of gadgets, I guess.
And gadgets.
I mean, I could see it. But I would say, but it very clearly, like you said, in this movie, he does not, they make a very clear determination that that is an act he's putting on, and that is not what he's like in reality. Like, his authentic self isn't that playboy-y Bruce Wayne figure that we do see in the other movies, the other iterations of these movies.
Yeah.
Right. Definitely. They definitely do that clear division. So when we talk about Bruce's trauma in this, one of the things that like stuck out to me was that with trauma, sometimes the way you can present it, like you can present it depending on onset, is it chronic or is it acute, meaning it was a short-term event and the symptoms, if they were acute, are only presented for a certain amount of time or for 6 months or less, or is it chronic where the symptoms are present for long periods of time? And with Bruce, it's clearly chronic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also he keeps re-traumatizing himself, which also is what can keep PTSD chronic, is if you're in situations where you keep being traumatized.
Right, right. You can definitely see how sometimes people who go back to war get re-traumatized or continue living that lifestyle some way, or people who've been in abusive relationships continue finding other abusive relationships. You can see how like the trauma pattern will repeat itself and they continue to get re-traumatized. And then the other thing we want to like highlight is the difference between complex versus single event trauma.
And he kind of is both. Well, right. Single event would be the shooting. That's a single event trauma.
Right. Or the bats.
Yeah. Or the bat when he falls in the well.
Right. But then it becomes complex when these traumas continue to come. When he goes on his adventure and ends up in
Thailand
or China or wherever it is that he goes.
Mm-hmm. His like self-imposed prison sentence.
Right. Yeah. An exile. And then like learning to fight and survive. Like that's the type of situation where you're entering complex trauma where danger is presenting to you in all forms, in many ways, in many situations, to the point where you're living in a dangerous situation. That's where he's going to cross from where he's likely dealing with a single event into complex trauma.
What like, else? Yeah.
Because he goes and he confronts Falcone in the restaurant.
The gangster?
Yeah, the gangster in the restaurant. And then he ends up, from that point on, like entering what's going to be a world of trauma for him, where he's got gangsters who speak English in the middle of the Chinese countryside, apparently, just fine. That doesn't happen. I've been there. That's not true. but then he is surrounded by gangsters who are attacking him. He has to steal to survive.
Yeah, also, he puts himself in a situation where he doesn't get his basic needs met on a regular basis. Like, he talks about, like, stealing because he was so hungry.
Right. Right. So all that we're going to enter into complex trauma situations, because there's multiple stressors, there's multiple dangers. In order to meet the criteria for trauma at all, I think this is something that must be talked about, is there's two categories of trauma that we generally recognize, although only one is in the DSM, and that is what we would call big T trauma. There's big T and little T. A little T trauma is any event that you might call distressing or upsetting, but in order for it to qualify for big T trauma, it must involve either the threat or knowledge of or actual event of death or dismemberment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or witnessing something similar to that.
Right, or witnessing, or it can also happen, like, if you work the same job that somebody did who also went through the same thing, like, you can get it that way, but it has to be knowledge of it happening, and it has to be death or dismemberment or bodily harm.
Yeah.
And you could say, because the argument would be, when in this very specific situation where a kid witnesses the death of both their parents and then becomes an orphan, you could argue that that's a big T trauma, and then everything after that are little T traumas, like going all home, like results. Waking up at home and your parents aren't there, you know, every time, like your first birthday where your parents dead, or like every time, like you have to do a different living situation or do something new without your parents. You know, can be called, like, can be sort of considered little T traumas even, as
like, well. And I mean, I don't know, because they're super rich, so it might be different for them, but like having to go to court to do any kind of legal stuff, like, where you have to, where, you know.
Or if he was a ward of the state in the real sense of the term, which is where you get shuffled around and you don't know where you're going to live. And like those would all be little T traumas following a big T trauma, which could arguably also be complex.
Right. Right. I mean, you can certainly make that argument, but when you're conceptualizing treatment, in order to even get to the PTSD diagnosis, big T trauma must be present in order for the diagnosis to be given. And I feel like in colloquial terms, when people use PTSD, it's been one of the terms that's been overused just like ADHD was in the 90s. Like, or OCD.
I'm so OCD because I love to clean. That's disrespectful.
It is disrespectful. But like people use like, oh, he's PTSD over this. Like, no. Like, that's...
Oh, like, it, oh my God, I have PTSD from that, like...
That movie.
From that movie we saw. And it's like, no. No. Not unless you already had PTSD from something similar to that movie that you just saw. But you're right. It has... I mean, it's not just having something unsettling happen to you or uncomfortable. Like, something really horrific has to happen to your person or witnessed by you happening to someone else's person.
Or knowledge of
it. Or knowledge of the... Yeah.
Like, knowing that something happened to a family member is enough to cause this in people. But it's not as likely as if someone directly experiences it. It's not guaranteed, but it's much, much more likely.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, we've kind of touched upon it, but depression-like symptoms can arise out of PTSD, which Absolutely. We see definitely with
and
him.
Anxiety.
Yeah, and like... His anger, for sure. I mean, definitely picking fights like he does. Like, it's all he's really doing is picking fights with everybody. And then this kind of sense of worthlessness that really comes off of him. Like, putting himself in these... You can't think much of yourself when you're putting yourself in the situations he chooses to put himself in. Like, I mean, like, he puts himself in prison. He puts himself in these horrible situations, which obviously he does not have to be in, because as soon as he decides not to be in them, he calls up his private jet and Daddy Alfred comes and picks him up.
Yeah, right.
So every second he's in these situations, like the prison, like Thailand or wherever he was, he is choosing to be there. Like, he's self-imposing these intense punishments, which we sometimes see, especially when I've worked with people who have been like sexually assaulted, like, and they have PTSD linked to that, like the feelings of worthlessness after that.
Sure.
And not feeling like you deserve things or that you deserve what happened to you. Well, and also not just a sexual assault, but like people I've worked with who are abusers children, like a sense of worthlessness because of what happened to you, or that maybe you deserved it, or maybe you did something that caused it to happen. And so then you kind of put yourself in positions where bad things can continue to happen to you, or where you kind of fulfill the identity of I'm bad, which he even says in this movie. He says, I'm a bad person, quote unquote, literally says. And so that can be like a presentation, all the stuff he chooses to do to himself in this movie. Though I think when I first saw this movie, I thought it was like just badass training. Like, you know, when I saw it when I was like 20, but now that I'm seeing it as the therapist, for me, it very clearly is someone who is punishing themselves.
Yeah. Or someone who's experiencing survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a combination for him. I think it's a combination of both. It seems like in some ways he's just punishing himself because he stayed alive and or because he couldn't protect his mom and his dad, even though he couldn't have because he was a child.
Yeah, but I think that's not an uncommon thought when I've worked with kids or grown-up versions of kids who had these similar experiences, feeling like you did something wrong, and you might
or
not.
Feeling
you might
like there was something else that you could have
done. When parents get divorced, when you have abusive parents, parents who do drugs, like there's sometimes that thought. And even if you can understand that it's not a realistic thought, the feeling, the core belief, might still be there that if I would have been a better kid, or if I would have listened more, or been better behaved, you know. Because in this direct situation, he chooses to leave the theater early, so he put himself, his parents, in the specific situation that got them killed.
Right, he's going to create guilt for that, for sure. Like, he's going to blame himself.
Like, if I wasn't so weak and scared, they wouldn't have died.
Right.
And I bet you that has morphed into a very solid core belief inside of him.
Yeah.
That he is weak, and his weakness killed his parents. And so, even though...
Raish preys on that with him. I'm sorry, Raj Agul. They call him Raz.
It's just because that's confusing with the girl being named Rachel.
Yeah, you throw me off every time you say it.
But,
sorry.
But Raj Agul.
Raish Agul, but we'll call him Raz.
Well, he's probably a predator of people just like him, just like Bruce, of finding people who are weak and kind of taking advantage of that.
I mean, sure, he builds his entire League of Shadows those people, the League of Assassins, League of Shadows, depending on which.
That's cult mentality. He's a cult leader, and he does the thing all cult leaders do, where there is like, I'm going to find the one thing that you're looking for, I'm going to pull it out of you, and I'm going to offer it to you.
Yep.
And then
you want to be able to be invisible so you can kill all the bad guys you want? I'm going to show you how to do that. So mm-hmm. you never have to be afraid again.
And he does the whole thing where he pokes at him and he's like, your dad was weak. It wasn't your fault. But he doesn't. It's like he almost does. He's like halfway there when he says it wasn't your fault that your parents died, but it was your dad's fault, because he's trying to piss him off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's trying to piss him off and he's trying to do a lot of things to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
But he also does a lot of things that a therapist may do, like it's twisted, but he goes to a lot of the things like where he's trying to make him take responsibility for who he is and what he's going to be, but it gets twisted into manipulation and cult leadership when he twists it again and then uses it as a weapon to manipulate him into who he wants him to be, as opposed to a benevolent force of working with him to go, hey, you don't need to carry this around anymore. This was not on you.
Well, I mean, how he works and how a lot of cult leaders work, or predators in general, is that they present themselves as like a sensei, like, you know, mentor type.
Yeah.
And they're abusing that situation and morph and perverting it into something
bad. Well, using their power as a power dynamic to try to get you to do what they want.
And when someone like Bruce, who is struggling with who he is, struggling with, I mean, he's probably waiting for someone to forgive him. Or tell him he can forgive himself, or give him the power to totally subvert that forgiveness prospect. But you know what I mean? Like, people like that, like, that's why we are very powerful in therapy when you work with someone with PTSD, not to get ahead of ourselves, but is to give them permission to forgive themselves, if that's where their head's at, or also to help them understand that that was not their fault.
Or even process the thoughts and feelings that they had in those moments of when things did happen, because there's a really good chance that they weren't able to do that at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were busy surviving, or busy taking care of someone, or busy, you know, blocking it out because it was so scary.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you see so much of this go on with these people. But with Bruce here, you want to see him find a way to forgive himself. But he never will. Like, he never will. He's going to turn it into anger so he can attack his villains.
Well, because Bruce is the king of not talking about your feelings. Bruce, Bruce Wayne is the king of shoving it down. Like, my note literally said, he is the king of shoving your feelings down deep inside of you. Like, he doesn't talk to anybody about how he feels. He doesn't even talk to Rachel. He doesn't talk to Alfred. So I doubt he talked about it when he was a kid. I mean, which is the sad part, this kid should have been in therapy ASAP after this happened. Yeah. And I'm strongly assuming that didn't happen.
No, and there's so much things, like, you see with Commissioner Loeb comes up to him and you see, like, even like it gives you like kind of a hint into how Bruce was treated and how this was regarded. Nobody but Gordon does anything to comfort him.
When he's little?
When he's little, right. Loeb, the guy who becomes the commissioner before Gordon does, comes up to him and says, you know, good news, son.
We got the guy. Like, the kid, like a kid would give a shit about that.
Like, right. Like, not like your parents survived.
Yeah. Like, kids
don't. Which is why you're like waiting to say your parents are okay.
Kids aren't thinking of justice like that.
No.
They just want their parents and to feel safe.
Right.
And,
or to know what's going to happen next. What's going to happen to me? My parents are gone. What is going to happen to me?
And like, yeah, Gordon, probably because Gordon is a father.
Yeah.
Was the only person who was like, hey, you probably need some tenderness right now.
Yeah.
Which is what kids need in those moments. They need to feel secure and they need to feel like someone, a grown up, is going to take care of them. Even if it's in just gestures.
Right. And Gordon was the only one that did that. And Loeb kind of created like, I'm sure it was a director's choice to show how, you know, Bruce didn't get that, like, let's guide you towards therapy. I mean, Alfred does a lot of things that are really positive, and the way he creates the message of it's not your fault, you didn't do this, it was him and him alone, are a lot of things you would hear from a therapist. But the value of having a therapist is that it's another adult who's not related to you, who you don't have emotional connection to, who can tell you these things and sit with you in them and not have an emotional attachment to them.
Well, they can tell it to you in a more objective way. Right. Like, the fact is, it wasn't your fault. Like, regardless of everything else and how you feel about it, the objective, realistic truth is it wasn't your fault.
Right.
And, I mean, that's a lot. But like I said, like, it's a hard thing, especially when you're young and that happens. Like, your brain can't think that abstractly. So you go right to the easiest answer or the easily connectable situation, which is, I wanted to leave the theater early because I left the theater early. It put us in this position where my parents died. Therefore, it is my fault. And he spends the rest of his life, probably arguably still as Batman, making up for that.
Oh, yeah.
And protecting himself against it.
Absolutely protecting. And
because I would argue, like, even when he comes back from college and he's like, I'm not going back to Princeton. I'm not feeling it. Like, I wrote down that I wondered if he was self-sabotaging.
Well, he said he likes it just fine, that they didn't feel the same way about him.
But I wonder, I bet he was, but I bet you he was self-sabotaging.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Princeton. Yeah, absolutely.
I bet you he has self-sabotaged everything because you want to.
He's probably drinking.
When you have the feelings of worthlessness, what you do is you continue to create situations that confirm how you feel. And so, or you just change your perception of something to confirm how you feel. Like, there might have been people at Princeton who were trying to support him and help him, and he might have not heard it or, you know, or retained it. You know, he could only see and hear the things that told him that he was bad.
Right. That he was responsible and that everything is his fault. And
I'm sure he self-sabotaged the shit out of those relationships. You know what I mean? Well, I'm sure he was hella distant.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, Christian Bale did a great job of conveying that, like, in his facial affect, to use our therapy term of the day, that he was, like, depressed and down and disconnected, and his hair and the way they did his makeup to make him look more sallow but and dark-eyed. His general, like, just lost to the world expression and given up on life kind of weight that he carried with him was really well portrayed. I mean, you believed that he was
depressed. He's no fun, dude. He is no fun. Like, I was just like, God, this guy is a goddamn bummer. Yeah, like, he just is. I mean, he looked good when he did that thing where he goes from standing to doing push-ups on the ground.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate that. But that's the funnest thing he does that whole movie.
Yeah.
Because
He jumps in the water with the models.
Oh, but we haven't gotten there yet. That is an act, which I think slides into the next part of this, which is identity. And we kind of touched upon this with Captain America, but I think it's prudent because in Captain America, Civil War, we talked about how in being a superhero, how do you create your identity so that you have an individual self for yourself? So you're like a whole healthy person and not just Superman or Spider-Man or Captain America.
Right.
And I feel like Bruce Wayne is the clearest example of what I was talking about, which is feeling like you can't be your own person when you've decided to become a superhero. That, like, your whole life. I'm getting ahead of myself, but one thing is he doesn't really know who he is, I would argue, because every part of him is inauthentic. And that when he's Batman, he's putting on this hella dramatic identity. He's got a fake ass voice. He's got this goofy ass costume. He, like, has a whole persona based around his fear. So it's like a costumed act.
Yeah.
Right.
And then when he's Bruce Wayne, he's not even real Bruce Wayne. He's not acting like himself. He's acting like this highfalutin douchebag version of himself swimming in hotel restaurant pools with models.
Right. Like, the only time you see him as, like, being his authentic self, you see him. He shows, like, part of it to Lucius, but always with Alfred. And you see some of it with Rachel. Like, he shows, like, an idealized self to her, but you always see it with Alfred. That's the only time you see him. He's, like, actually Bruce.
Yeah.
Like, he becomes Bruce
Wayne. I don't know, man. I feel like I don't know if he knows who he is. I feel like he kind of gloms on to who he thinks Alfred wants him to be or who Rachel wants him to be. I don't know if he has an authentic self.
I think he kind of acts like probably the kid version of himself with Alfred.
Yeah.
But that isn't a grown version of himself.
Yeah.
Like, the way he does the joking and the teasing and the slouching and the, I want to sleep in. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He is more probably how he's always been with Alfred since he was 10 and Alfred became his guardian.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's probably true.
I would say with Rachel, he wants to be an authentic version of himself, but he doesn't know how to be an authentic version of himself, which is why that keeps falling flat and blowing up in his face.
Well, every time, like, you see him so badly want her approval Because she starts talking about, like, the social justice kinds of theme that runs in this movie and all the things that she's doing to try to fight that and to try to make that happen and what you should really be doing if you want to make things better. And as he's living the mask of Bruce Wayne, Playboy, he is every single thing that she is talking about being the problem.
Yeah.
And then he has to know that inside him, he is doing every single thing to be the hero that she is talking about, at least the twisted version he thinks she's talking about. It's not really what she's saying, but what he hears it as, like, you feel like he's going, like, but that's what I'm doing. I'm out there hitting the bad guys.
But he's made the decision to create this whole separate identity. Like, he has decided that in order to be that person, which is what she finds distaste for, is that he has to be a... like, not a clown, that's really, that's kind of
caricature.
Rude. But he has to be a character. Like, he has to be a comic book hero. Like, he has to, yeah, like, be a caricature of something. And that he can't, like, and me and Hannah kind of talked about this off mic, but why, I mean, his story is very similar to Iron Man's story, but why I think we found Iron Man more likable, sorry guys, is that Iron Man just kind of, Tony Stark just kind of owns it. Like, this is his whole personality, is being Tony Stark and Iron Man. And he does have some struggle with trying to find balance within that, but it's all a part of him. That's him totally. Whereas why...
Like, Tony Stark is always being Tony Stark.
Always.
Even when he's Iron Man.
And Batman doesn't know who the fuck he is.
He's being a version...
He just is making all of these decisions based on what he thinks people want him to be, or what he thinks will help himself be better, but really he's just splitting himself in half.
Well, he's persona. It's all personas. Like, he's either the persona of Batman, or he's the persona of Bruce Wayne.
Right. And that's
quote
true.
Quote-unquote Bruce Wayne.
And then when, like... Again, you don't see it in this movie, and I'm going to contain this, but, like, you see, like, you see Batman later on, like, when Robin's in the picture, like, he'll adopt this, like, dad, like this asshole dad thing, because he thinks Robin needs that, and he just, like, doesn't let him do anything, doesn't let him help, doesn't let him engage, and you just see that start to form. You don't see that with this particular Batman, so I'll stop it there, because I could talk about Batman for a long time.
We will not
Batman
allow
fan,
it.
But
we
they
will
won't allow me
not
to
allow
do it.
It.
If you're interested, welcome. Though, I suggest strongly, there's a book by Travis Langley called Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night. Highly, highly recommend reading that one.
Yeah, I mean, because he is rife with mental health issues.
His villains are, too.
Well, he's such a clear, like, and I guess where I was going with initially when I brought this up is because his identity and his feelings of self-worth are so obliterated already.
Yeah.
He is rife for having identity issues like this.
Absolutely.
Like, not knowing who he is, trying to figure out who he is by being, because it's safe to be Batman and this fake ass Bruce Wayne character, because that doesn't have anything to do with him and him actually being his real, authentic, vulnerable self. Like, he's just putting on a mask, literally and figuratively.
And also, he never has to be his vulnerable self, because he can just continue to kind of play these roles.
Like,
and he
fake
never
versions.
Exactly. He doesn't ever have to tap into that part of himself or allow all those feelings that he's been shoving down his whole life to come out in any way.
And also,
he can just do that.
No, he only ever shows... This is where he gets into, like, the Bond-like kind of thing, the American Bond. Is like, he only shows it to beautiful women that he's got a love interest in, like Rachel or Chase Meridian or
who?
Selina Kyle.
You're losing us, dude.
Yep.
She's from the Batman Forever, Nicole Kidman.
Oh.
Her name is Dr. Chase Meridian. It was like
that would
the,
be fun to do eventually
name.
On this podcast, because isn't she a psychologist? She's portrayed realistically and authentically.
Well, you know, Dr. Crane, Scarecrow, is a psychiatrist, too, and he's...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And so is two of his main villains are psychiatrists, with him and Hugo Strange.
All right.
But see, this is where I'll contain myself.
But I would say, too, on top of what kind of what both of you were saying, is that he still has, even in the movie when he's with those women, he's very bravado still. And I wonder also, when you can put this persona up and not be your real self, then you're not allowing yourself to be close to other people, and therefore you cannot lose other people, which is probably deeply tied into his trauma, like a deep, deep, probably deep fear of commitment and family, which, if we're going to get into other Batman stuff, like in the Lego Batman movie, they really address hard and hilariously how scared he is of being in a family. That's like, they say how that's his biggest fear, and he kisses sharks, I think. But they're like, no, it's not sharks. It's being in a family. And he's like, shut up.
Snakes, but, and then it's snake clowns.
Oh, okay. Snake clowns.
I was like, oh, no, I'm afraid of snake clowns because you made me think of that. And he yells at Alfred.
But I think, but when you are a role, not a real person, when you're just roles, then you can't ever really be close to anybody. And so it is a way of protecting yourself, which might be a version of his hypervigilance as well.
Yeah.
Of keeping himself.
Absolutely.
Well, and also not even necessarily hypervigilance, but in PTSD, we do see a lot of times, and depression, like you said, withdrawing, distancing yourself from others.
Yep.
Keeping trying yourself from being hurt.
Yeah, trying to find ways to keep yourself from being hurt. I mean, going back to the identity, he doesn't even know who Bruce Wayne is. Like, even when he was a little boy, like, he doesn't know. I think that that part is what continues to keep him unstable in that way. Because even as a little boy, just having that identity starting then and then losing his parents. Mm-hmm. And now who is he? And I think so, not even having kind of like that base foundation of only knowing his name is Bruce Wayne. And that means he's tied to all of these other things. But really, who is he? And what is it like for him?
And he has that screaming fit with Alfred where he's like, I don't care about my name, because Alfred's like, you're a fucking Wayne. He doesn't say it like that. But
yeah.
And so I wonder what it would be like to have all this identity issues and also all this guilt tied to your identity because of your parents' death, and then having all these expectations surrounding your name and identity from other people.
And have it in your industry face all the time. Yeah. And also having everybody knows who you are.
I bet it would make you
really... Which is why he goes, which I think in part, besides he wants to punish himself,
right,
why he goes to a foreign country, because he doesn't want anyone to know who he is. He wants...
anonymity.
Right, but then I don't think he even wants that.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know what he wants either.
Right, because as soon as he gets out of his anonymity, he calls the private
jet. He calls
his
fucking jet.
And like, he's like, at the end of the day, though. At the end of the day, though, I do know I'm rich.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, I mean, like, that might be the only one true thing that he actually knows and is in some ways a positive.
He got money.
A positive core belief that he has, that I have money. So if anything really does happen, I can pay for myself to get out of it.
Like, he has all the money to finance him being Batman. He writes that check to that hotel in a really like douche move, like, I'm buying this fucking hotel. Like, he has all the protection of money, which I think might be the big but it also makes sense that might be the only real comfort he's ever had after his parents died, is at least I know I'll always have money and be financially stable, you know. And even when I choose to put myself in these bad situations, I can get out of it. It would be interesting how he would be if he didn't have that to fall back on. I wonder if he would put himself in such perilous situations in such dangerous countries if he didn't know he could just call Daddy Butler and get out of there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this would be such a different character without
the money
part, without the money and the name.
Yeah.
The Wayne last name and the money that's behind it. I mean, I don't know. I don't think the story would be like this at all.
I wonder if he would have just lived into that prison until he died, because Ra's al Ghul also wouldn't have been interested in him. So
he wouldn't have been anybody.
Right, because he wouldn't have known who he is or his story.
Yeah.
And he would have had, he probably would have had a bigger chance of becoming a ward of the state. Probably would have been, I mean, like, all of the parts of his story.
He probably
would
have been a villain and not Batman. Like, a bad guy.
Yeah.
He probably would have been just this typical, like, fighting,
survival,
assault, you know.
Yeah.
Probably got a prison
survival
for assault
based
and battery.
Crime.
Yeah.
Slash.
Drug addiction, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a character like that called Hush in Batman's story. But I'm sorry. I'll contain it.
This is hilarious, Ben.
We talked about this.
Yeah. There's no dogs in this one, Hannah, so I have to...
Yeah, that's a fair point. Okay.
But
there's no dogs or Jedi, I have to, like, okay. I mean...
When we eventually
it's
do...
It'll be like Star Wars 1, like Batman number 2, like,
well,
as
now,
far as things
now.
I know
when
about.
When we eventually do Harry Potter, me and Hannah will have to check ourselves before we wreck ourselves, so
I get it. Yeah, totally.
But
totally.
I think also it ties into the identity stuff when we've talked about Ra's al Ghul being, like, a cult leader. Like, that also is what makes him so perfect for that situation, is cult leaders and predators latch on to people who do not have a sense of identity because they're waiting for someone to tell them who they are.
Yeah.
And so he is, and then Ra's al Ghul does that thing kind of like we talked about with Kylo Ren in Star Wars, where this misguided belief that in order to become your new self or like your truest self, you have to burn.
You have to give up
your
everything.
History and your family and everything you're connected to. Like, like some fucked up version of going into a cocoon and coming out a butterfly. Yeah. It's like you have to destroy your whole body into mush. But with a lot of civilian casualties.
Yeah.
Which is a, which is just a version. It's like the most extreme aggressive version of shoving down and ignoring all your feelings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because it's like, I'm going to burn all my feelings to the ground so I never have to talk about anything because I won't be there. And then I'll, and it's also the thing we touched upon with anger, which is this feeling of that once I get rid of this thing that's causing me harm or holding me back, then I'll feel a sense of relief as if that's, as if you'll forget that that thing existed, which is, which doesn't happen.
Right. Anger's not an orgasm.
I mean, like in Kylo Ren's case, he killed his dad, didn't feel any better.
No, it broke
him
further.
And then was all fucked from that. And at least what was good about Bruce Wayne, and maybe that's because he has beautiful, beautiful sunflower Alfred.
Yes.
Is that when Raj is like, let's burn Gotham to the ground. He's like, I'm just going to burn you guys to the ground if that's all right with you guys. He burns their place to the ground, which is a hella drama move. It's a very extreme switch. Yeah,
it's a very, like, I'm sure he could have worked out a better way
he to couldn't have
get
been
his
like,
point across.
Hey, I think I'm going to go to town for, like, a quick bite, you know, just to switch it up. Yeah. And then I'm never going to come back because my dad butler's going to pick me up in the big plane.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think he could have just been like, yeah, okay, I can do that.
And because also, what's so fucking stupid about that? This is just a plain up critique of this movie.
Yeah.
Is that he's motherfucking Bruce Wayne. This guy knows he's Bruce Wayne. Everybody and their mom knows he's Bruce Wayne. He didn't think this was going to come back on his ass.
Right.
Like, even if he thought they all died in that, this doesn't feel like the kind of place where they don't have, like, mob-like ties. Where someone couldn't come find his ass.
Well, right, and they talk about,
and
like, we're an ancient organization. We brought down cities. Like, they talk about how, like, we brought down Rome, we brought down Egypt, we brought down everything, like London, that was us, we put plague rats on the ships, like all of this stuff, like all of this clearly interconnected stuff, and like what they don't like cover in this movie is who like Ra's actually is, and that he, like they hint that he's like the demon and he's immortal, but what they don't hint is like that he's the one that did all that shit. It's not that he, like, was his organization
like a predecessor.
Did it. It wasn't a predecessor. He did that because he has this Lazarus
So
bit.
I guess...
So if he gets hurt, he can be immortal.
So I guess the argument is, do you think that is just, like, a rash, impulsive decision on Bruce Wayne's part? Because he is a pretty rash, impulsive person.
Absolutely.
Like, he does put himself in all these, like, he's not a fucking gymnast. Like, they do a good job in this movie of showing when he's, like, trying out, like, the prototype of Batman.
Right.
And, like, eating it.
Right.
Like, trying to, like, jump on buildings and stuff. And so he puts himself constantly in the situations, impulsively or maybe intentionally, where he is in danger. Like, he's not thinking about... He's never thinking about his own safety and his body's well-being. Which, with PTSD, it can go either way. Where you're either where you're really concerned about your safety and you kind of lock in and you're really protective of yourself.
And you won't do anything. Yeah.
Or you are... whatever, who cares what happens to my body.
Well, just high risk behaviors.
Yeah.
I mean, he, you know, I think I talked about this off mic about how I just really feel like he wished that he would have died with his parents. I mean, I think he's always putting himself in peril. He's always in these situations that he is making up. He's a rich white man.
He doesn't have
to
be Batman.
Like, he's fine. He doesn't need to do any of this extra shit that he's doing. He is creating all of these things. And I mean, clearly, based on what we've already talked about, it's because of his trauma and because of how he feels about himself and not having an identity for himself. But it's also just like, you didn't have to do all that stuff, man.
Well, because it's
like you're Chris Rock from Longest Yard right now. Like, hey, you're white. Smile.
Well, I mean, because here's the argument.
Here's the
comparative argument.
If he,
with the identity stuff, Captain America, let's use him as the example.
Sure.
He got his body altered. Like, he was gifted with his body being different. And so there's a feeling of, I'm indebted to do this work because I have this body now and this strength.
Right. And I was this man's, like, life's
and that's part of where the identity gets so scrambled, because it's like, well, then who am I when I feel like I have to do this stuff?
Right.
Whereas Bruce Wayne is putting it upon himself to do all this stuff.
Nobody's...
And also, he could go about this a thousand different ways.
Oh, of course.
Nobody is making him be Batman. Nobody asked for Batman. Like, he just fucking did it because he wanted to.
Well, he did it out of his own
stuff. I mean, I know he did it out of his own stuff, but I'm just saying, like...
That's what makes the identity
true,
discussion...
True, but I have to tell you that I starkly disagree that he wants to die. Like, he wants so badly for
to feel alive,
to feel like he has righted all the wrongs and he has like gotten everybody. Like he doesn't stop. He wants to be the one that fixes everything. Like he never wants to be the one that died. He wants it to never happen again and not be his fault. I've never seen like the I just wish I died with my parents. Like I've never seen Batman say something like that.
Well, why do you think?
Well, look, he doesn't talk. He doesn't fucking talk about his feelings or his thoughts. So you're never going to see that happen. Number one. Number two, I don't understand a place where somebody would put themselves in these kinds of positions and want to be alive.
He goes through a lot of effort to keep himself alive. I mean, in Dark Knight, you even see it. Like, what's the difference between me and you when you get all the other extra Batmans? I'm not wearing hockey pads. Like, they go through a lot of effort to get him a body armor that stops, like, assault rifle rounds.
Devil's advocate, though, Ben. Devil's advocate. Because I know you're coming from the energy of the entire Batman universe. And I get that. And I respect
it, kind of.
It's
just going to happen.
And
there's dogs there.
But listen. In the vacuum that is just this movie.
Right.
If you don't know anything else about Batman, what would you think then?
I would still not think he wanted to die. I think he'd want to do everything in his power to make it right and that he would waste his dying breath doing it, not that he wished for death.
That's some real needing to be validated for your existence, though.
They show that with him all over the place, though. Yeah. His need to be validated. They show it the hardest with Rachel. But
he definitely wants, like, warm and fuzzies from her. Like, he definitely wants he wants some pats on the head from her. But I think, and I get where she's coming from, is that she's, to her own peril, is showing her own real face. You know what I mean? When she's fighting for things. Like, and I think what she argues, and she's not wrong, is that your name carries weight. You don't have to be a fucking bat in a costume to do what you're doing.
Right.
You're choosing to make this a fucking hullabaloo.
Right.
And
absolutely.
It doesn't have to be. But I think that is all, like we keep saying, part of him not knowing who he is and just creating this like bonkers persona so he can be the farthest version of who he is. So he doesn't have to figure out who he is. Because I think what we talked about a little bit is, and I think you said it, Hannah, is your parents are the biggest informers of who you are. And your family unit are the biggest informers of who you are and who you'll be. Like nature versus nurture, like the argument people make is the nurture part is how your family raises you, the kind of values they put into you, who they tell you they are by how they praise you and how they punish
with you and talk
stuff.
About you and everything
and like religion you have and like the government party you belong to, like all that stuff is formed by your parents. And so when you lose that at a young age, everything has to come from you, and so everything is probably harder and slower and more rife with confusion and doubt.
I would say I feel like he has so much doubt about himself and not knowing how to trust himself. Because I think a lot of times how children learn trust is with their parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's and not that he can't trust Alfred, but that I think that because of the really specific kind of odd type of relationship that they have makes it really hard for him to learn trust from Alfred. Because in some ways, I'm sure he knows in his little heart that Alfred is being paid to manage this role, this part
of
his life.
It would be a very easy way for his brain to reject their relationship and reject that affection and intimacy is by, especially if he's already feeling worthless and feeling having survivor's guilt and stuff of being
absolutely.
He's just paid to be nice to me. He's just paid to love me or act like he loves me.
I think
it would
be really
me,
easy for him to put that in its own little box.
Based
on his trauma.
Right. I'm certain that in a anger moment that would be something that came out. Absolutely.
I mean, this might be actually a question for you, Benjamin, is does he not have grandparents and or aunts and uncles that
or
could have
anybody?
Taken care of him? He doesn't have any relations.
There's nobody else.
Nope. There's nobody else in his world. I don't know what happened to them, but no, there's never been anybody else. He's always been the only child.
And every version of him.
And every version of him is he's been the only child of these two philanthropist people.
Who also don't have any family.
Who don't have any family. And that's why they have Alfred. The only family he has is Alfred's brother. Like, that's the closest.
Oh, so still.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Like, and Alfred's an interesting character. Like, you could do a whole thing on him. I'll retain it. But what do you
I love
like?
Him.
Alfred is a.
I love Alfred.
Yeah, Alfred's like a former SAS, like
what?
Assassin badass.
What?
You didn't know
what?
That?
Says who?
I know he talks about it in The Dark Knight when he goes through his speech about some men just want to watch the world burn.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Sean Pertwee's Alfred is probably my favorite. The one from Gotham.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's the one you believe most will fuck you
he's
up.
He's a more rough and tumble version of Alfred. But like, he's got like a Cockney accent. Like, he does look like he could snap your arm really felt like it.
I think he's a bad guy in a lot of
The classic Alfred.
Guy Ritchie movies.
Whereas, like, there's the classic Alfred from, like, the Michael Keaton days, who looks like he might snap in half if he doesn't turn too quick.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, Alfred is a former, like, special operations soldier. Like, he chooses, like, this different life, which is why...
That also makes the Jeremy Irons version of Alfred in Batman vs. Superman make more sense. Because he definitely has more tougher...
Correct.
Vibe about him.
Yeah, Alfred is, and even in the cartoon, they kind of cover this, where, like, you see there's an Alfred-centric episode with his brother, like, they don't reveal any of this until later.
You are so deep in Batman,
I know, it's Star Wars is the only thing I'm worse than this
so
on.
So deep in Batman.
I know.
But I mean, I think Bruce Wayne is a sad... rich man. I mean, like, he is rich. which maybe is our bad, because I think there is this idea that, like, when you have a certain class or a certain amount of money, like, why can't you get your shit together a little bit? But
right, which,
but I mean, also, it is that thing where I think, because when people have resources, or even when people are, like, really smart, like, you think we should be able to pull it together, like, you'll be fine. Because you're not going to have financial difficulties. I wonder if that's part of maybe why he was just kind of left alone with his butler. And no one really, like, dwelled on it.
Maybe.
It's because he's a Wayne, though. He's got a ton of money. Like, he'll be fine. He'll make it out of here. Like,
I mean, it could
he'll go to French schools
and
stuff.
It could also be a part where somehow he is just looked aside because there's so many other things going on. Gotham is such a hard city to begin with. And to have two of their most prominent... kind rich people around,
the king and queen of Gotham,
them murdered in front of their child,
and then I'm sure all the business people were just looking at the business
parts, and in that way where he they did all the business parts and they did the who has custody of him and they did all of those things, but then nobody was like, hey, maybe we should like see if he's okay because his parents died in front of him, like, it doesn't happen because there's no, but also who would say that? Who would be like, teachers would say that, or friends, or he doesn't seem to have anyone besides Alfred, who is then, from what it seems like, is also managing the entire business on top of taking care of him.
Well, Alfred doesn't manage the business. That's what that other douchey
guy, Rutger.
Rutger Howard. Yeah.
But I bet you that was the scramble when his parents died. It wasn't who's going to take care of this kid. It probably was like, who's going to take over the business.
Right. Yeah. And like, no one comforts a kid. Even that guy, well, I can't remember what his name was. We'll call him Phillips for the moment.
Cool.
Daniels. I don't know what the fuck. They just use his last name. But Rutger Howard's character, like, comes up to him. Yeah, the business guy comes up to him and says, like, your empire will be safe when you're waiting for it.
He doesn't give a fuck.
No, he's a total d-bag.
He's not making that money and trying to get as much of it in his pocket before Bruce is old enough to figure it out.
But I think, like, people do think that simplistically sometimes, you know, about, like, basic need stuff. Like, like, that's not something dissimilar to when I've worked with adoptive kids and stuff, being like, well, he's getting everything he needs. Why is he having such a problem still? And it's like, well, that's not... But when they say getting everything he needs, they mean... food, shelter, clothing, nice things. And I'm like, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, they need that, of course. You always need, like, your basic needs to survive. But that's not the end-all be-all of being a full, healthy person.
No.
Right.
And I bet you that's probably where he fell in the cracks, is people were like, he's going to be fine. He's fucking rich.
Yeah.
I mean, that definitely is something that happens. And we can see that here. There's bias. I mean... right now, given that it's 2018 and there is a lot of class warfare going on right now, I think it's hard to, like, kind of escape, because, like, we as therapists, like, kind of sit in the middle of that. We're often saddled with a lot of debt and we work with people who have literally nothing.
Yeah.
Many times. Like, you work with
and so it is hard to watch someone who has so many resources choose to go
struggle.
To third world countries and, like, get the shit kicked out of him and not have his basic needs met and steal food from people who probably are making less money than him. Like, when he talked about, I had to steal food because I was hungry, I was like, you're not really fucking hungry, you douche. Like, you're stealing food from probably a fucking, like, market keeper, like a shopkeeper, who probably is starving.
Right.
because you're choosing to self-impose a hard life upon yourself.
And that's true. And in therapy, one of the things that we see is, like, you see that's like the great equalizer here is that, like, we see that despite all of that reality that you're talking about here, like, that, I mean, that's of course true. Like, this guy is trying to compare himself to the world of people who literally have nothing.
Yeah.
Who are fighting for survival. And he's like,
and he well, is I one want... call away from a private jet.
Right, which he does. Which is, like, okay, that's super privileged. There's no two ways around that. Like, that's definitely,
it's
like...
It's hard to have empathy for him in that way when it comes to that part. I mean, I think... talking about what happened to him and how his trauma and identity makes it hard for like all the reasons we've already talked about. But it's just, it's hard in some ways. It's hard for me to have empathy for him based on the experience that I've had and based on the people that we've worked with and just knowing like there are some things that he didn't have to do the things that he did.
Right. As opposed to people who that life came for them.
Exactly.
Because I mean, what I said off mic to both of you guys, and this is a superhero reference, but like the show Arrow, which is a very similar story of like a billionaire playboy
right.
who becomes a vigilante superhero of a, and he's like, his family's like the king and queens of that town. But he crashed on an island and had to survive on that island for 5 years.
Right.
And so it wasn't like he chose to live on that island
right.
and keep himself on that island.
Well, depending on how deep into the storyline we go.
But you know what I mean.
Right.
And so it was not, it's not a self-imposed exile. You know what I mean? And with, and with Bruce Wayne, specifically this Christian Bale version of Bruce Wayne,
yeah.
right.
he is choosing to do this himself. And I get maybe the argument you're making too, which is important to remember, Ben, is that experiences are relative. So even with money and things like that and resources, your experience is always relevant to your life.
Right.
So that's
right.
why
it can
compared. Be hard. That's why it can be hard to have quote unquote perspective, which can feel very ungrateful, you know, when you're working with someone who might have a better quote unquote better life than other clients we have.
Correct.
But, you know, experience is relative and you have to try to keep that in mind when working with them, even when it can be harder because they are putting themselves in positions that they don't have to be in. Which, I mean, you see with privileged people who choose to get involved with drugs, you know, unsafe sex behaviors, like dangerous, you know, things like that, like dating people that aren't good for them, you know, take like ruining jobs, self-sabotaging, kind of like he does, self-sabotaging good opportunities, you know. And part of that could be because there is that cushion of protection of resources and family and money. But part of it is because you can't see beyond your own pain in your own life. Like, even though you
absolutely.
Can have intellectual perspective, it's hard to really, truly, like, feel like I should be truly grateful because I could live like this.
Right.
Like, to actually feel it deep in your bones.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So when we talk about Bruce, if he were to come into the office, what would we want to do? I know that where my approach would be off the bat, but I'm gonna save that because I can get lengthy about talking about EMDR. I've talked about it a lot, but Bruce is such a prime candidate for that.
He really is.
That, I thought that, I don't even do EMDR, but I definitely thought that watching
it just,
from little I know about
it.
It
just seems like his flashbacks are so specific and so, like, coming in and processing those exact memories with him, I think would just help him so much.
Well, maybe because we've already
so
opened
much.
It. Maybe you should just go into it because we've already opened the door.
Okay, well,
sorry.
Right. It's fine.
Sorry.
It's fine. I know I've talked about EMDR a lot and I don't want to, like, dominate that, but I do EMDR and I do believe strongly in it from both sides of the couch. Like, I've experienced it and do it and I believe in it strongly. So EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Operates on the general theory that your mind has adaptive processing network and kind of like RAM in a computer where your memories are stored in files and kind of you access them and they're all interconnected and they can communicate with each other and you let go of things that aren't useful like emotions and you learn from them what happened and how to integrate and synthesize that information into a cohesive awareness of life.
Damn, those are some $5 words. But I think I said last time you said this
words.
As well.
Yep. But indeed. What EMDR also conceptualizes is that trauma memories get stored in their own channel, independent of that adaptive processing network. Now, that being said, Bruce's traumas, I like to liken it to a GIF or Netflix, to use 2018 kind of references, is that when you have a trauma memory, it's that same thing. It repeats over and over. It's like a clip of a scene. It's a loop. Right. It's the same thing over time, and or every time, over time, all the time. And that memory becomes like when you're trying to watch something on Netflix or any streaming service in general, where the big picture comes up on the screen, and it's always that same big picture, and the rest of your memories in life might run by, like, the fast-forward bar down at the bottom, where, like, there's a little bit, you go like, oh, yeah, I watched that part, and...
You can scroll through it, but these memories you can't scroll past.
Right, they stand out. You can't scroll, you get stuck on them, you get reactivated, and you remember them...
You know what it's like?
Like,
it's
when, like, they happened.
Back in the day when you'd listen to CDs or watch DVDs, and there'd be a scratch... And it would get stuck on that one scene on a DVD.
Yeah.
And it would just play that scene over and over, and you couldn't, like, really fast forward it or rewind it properly. It would just get back to that.
Oh, it was the worst. Yeah. or like the beginning of the DVD where they, like, played music in that same scene.
Oh, the menu scene?
Where if you, like, fall asleep and the menu scene would play for, like, 6 hours straight and it'd be burned into your nightmares. Yeah.
But I think why Bruce stuck out to me and Hannah, who aren't practitioners of EMDR, watching it ourselves, is he's such a clear case of someone who is having very specific flashbulb memories that are impacting arguably everything that's going on with them.
I mean, on a day-to-day basis, like, this is somebody who is experiencing flashbacks on a regular enough basis that it almost seems like not doing EMDR doesn't make sense.
And they're such two specific memories.
Right. And so with EMDR, what I would do with that is, I mean, we would want to identify what the negative cognition he has about himself with that memory. We'd want to identify what he'd like to believe about himself instead. We'd want to find out where in his body he feels that. And then we would
He would have to do
I
feel it in my fist. Punch you in the face.
He might have to do
in the face. He'd be like, swear to me.
He might have to do some
metal voice.
Thoughts and feelings, like, and how he experiences those before you could do EMDR with him. Like, you would have to probably have him be more comfortable with that for it to really work, don't you think?
I think, if we were going to talk about, like, setting him up for EMDR, because EMDR can be intense, and it's something that you usually need to do some work on coping skills, and based on the way he doesn't seem to accept things or deal with
advice from others.
He doesn't
have coping skills.
He has zero coping skills.
His coping skills,
he doesn't know those words mean.
His coping skills is to go out and fuck shit up.
In a fucking and put himself outfit.
And because what I'd be worried about?
Outfit though.
Well,
is it
when it doesn't have the bat nipples? Bat nipples are bad.
Okay, but like, because he definitely would be someone that probably, if you really did something hard in session, he'd probably go out and pick a fight and hurt himself.
Yeah,
and try to hurt himself.
I mean, that's possible for sure. Or he'd shut down and do nothing with it.
He'd reject it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. But, I mean, he might do it. He might also be willing, because you see in Batman Forever, they hypnotize him. And he seems willing, but that's Val Kilmer's version and not Christian Bale's, which I have
and
pretty stark
Val Kilmer's version is a much more fleshed out person in terms of he can joke and, like, flirt and as himself, not as, like, Bruce Wayne the character.
Right, and he's also 10 years older, so.
True. I think also wears turtlenecks.
He does. And glasses.
Turtlenecks.
But, I mean, I think it would be very interesting. I can't imagine him stepping into a therapist's office at that age. Unless he started dating Rachel and she was like, I'll only keep dating you, dude, if you go to therapy.
He gets various, like, mentors and doctors. I don't know if you guys watch Gotham, but...
Not anymore.
He has a doctor that he sees. They call her Lee.
But that's kid Bruce.
Adult Bruce sees her too.
What? Is he adult in that show too? Sorry, I'm sidebarring hard right now.
No, that character exists outside of Gotham.
All right.
Well, she's usually shown as much older than she's shown with Marina Bakarin playing her. But
in the vacuum of this movie.
In the vacuum of this movie, this character has clearly had no treatment. But if we were to bring him in to do EMDR... What we would want to do is EMDR uses what's called bilateral stimulation, which is either eye movements where you have somebody track your fingers with your eyes to kind of simulate REM, which they found has where your brain reorganizes information. So what we're doing when we do that, it may look and sound goofy and ridiculous, and I fully understand and respect that. It's fine. It sounds like alien shit. It's weird. However, when you do it, what it does is it helps kind of break the tunnel vision you have of that memory and allows you to see, hear, smell, notice more aspects of that memory because it's engaging both sides of your brain as opposed to just where this memory is stored. And it helps you break the walls that keep this memory secluded from everything else. And then you can integrate it back into your brain and evaluate it with the full information of your adult calm self. Which, if you're talking about something that happened with a 10-year-old child, the fear and terror and not knowing what's going on or having any control of the world is how he evaluates that memory every time. Mm-hmm. EMDR would help him go back as an adult to maybe synthesize into his concept of the event some of the things that Alfred tells him, you know, it wasn't your fault, it's not your fault, it was all him, he did it.
Well, being able to look at it more realistically right. from an outsider perspective.
Right.
Instead of just being kind of immersed in your thoughts and emotions of when it happened. So it lets you really step out. Don't know how to do it EMDR, but I've been on the other side of it, and it's just works really well. I mean, it's very effective and can really help people move past some of the places that they've been stuck.
It would be interesting to see what he would be like after that. Because I think once those two memories lost steam, I don't wonder how motivated he would be to still be Batman.
Yeah.
Or at least this.
It would depend at which
version.
Point in his life I think we get him.
Yeah.
I'm trying to fucking imagine getting buy-in with him, period, treatment-wise.
Because I think he's so stuck in thinking he's doing the right thing. I mean, not for his well-being, but like the right thing, period. And on a more like global scale.
And the only thing that keeps these identities that he feels connected to somehow, he has to because he's so working so hard to maintain both of them.
Right.
That I don't know if he would. How do you get somebody to feel to trust you and to know that you can help them? And to trust you and believe you.
I don't know. I wonder if he would be a version of his personas with you.
Yeah.
Like, if he would even truly be, if he'd be like, yuck yuck Bruce Wayne with you. Or if he would be, oh my god, wouldn't it be wild if you were like in the middle of session and he used like his Batman voice? I'd be like, oh shit, we got some stuff to talk about today.
Let it go.
But also, like, you know what would be interesting if you did kind of like the Gestalt stuff, Gestalt, what we call Gestalt therapy, which is where you talk to other parts.
Yeah.
I'm getting right, correct? It's Gestalt.
Well, I mean, that could be Gestalt or that could be
the
family.
System stuff?
Internal family systems.
Yeah,
IFS.
Where
that'd be where
you will talk to other versions of yourself, like you would talk to the child version of yourself and then maybe talk to like your mom, you know what I mean? Or like other roles of your family or other versions of yourself. So I think what would be really wild to do would be to make him talk to and or as Batman and this bullshit version of Bruce Wayne he's put on, like Playboy Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And then maybe little kid Bruce Wayne.
Right.
And then maybe his parents, who he hasn't seen and, you know, who died when he was so young, and see what comes out of that. I think him talking to those different personas he's put on would be very interesting.
Oh, it'd be fascinating. It'd be absolutely fascinating.
For sure.
So I know that, I mean, I would want to go with EMDR for him, for sure. What about you two?
Well, I am going to go totally off base. And instead of thinking, I guess what my whole thought was, and we kind of touched upon it, as a kid therapist who does a lot of work with families and with parents, and I've done a lot of work with adopted kids and foster kids where they are in a situation where a totally random new person's taking care of them, whether it's an adoptive parent, a grandparent, a cousin, a aunt, like an older sibling, where you have to figure out the new dynamic of your relationship. And I cannot imagine what it would be like to work with someone where their guardian is also their butler. Like, what is that dynamic? Because it would be contingent upon a lot of things that I think I'd have to understand as a therapist in order to move forward, which is he being paid? Is he being paid by the estate? Or is he just going to stipend like you would if you were a foster parent? Is he getting... Is Bruce aware of this status? Is it being verbalized? How are they referring to each other now? Because he still calls his grown-ass master Bruce. Sometimes he does it to yell at him, kind of like when you call your kid by their full name.
Yeah.
He's right. Like, Master Bruce. He's like, you come fucking over here so I can whoop that ass.
Yeah.
But did he do that as a kid after his parents died? Like, that is wild. And so a lot of what I would need to know is, one, what are they calling each other?
Yeah.
Two, how has their roles changed now that he's the guardian? Like, does he still do all the butlery stuff? Or would that even be different because butlers also do things that your parents would do, which is, like, make you food and, you know, help with chores and stuff?
Right, and I think it's super clear that Alfred absolutely, takes on that role.
And so then it's like, is there allowed to be affection, or is there still the distance that exists between, like, servant and master? You know, is there, like, how has this dynamic shifted, and what is Alfred comfortable doing differently? Because it wouldn't be a lot of those decisions. Some of those decisions would be Bruce's, like, what do you want to call Alfred? What do you want Alfred to call you? Like, what do you need from him? But the first step would be talking to Alfred, probably one-on-one, and being like, what do you want to be to this kid?
Yeah.
Like, do you want him to call you dad if he wants to call you dad eventually?
How do you see this relationship changing in the wake of his parents being murdered?
Like, do you already feel affectionate? Because I don't know nothing.
I think Bruce would resent him if he tried to, like, assume the mantle of dad.
Well, I don't. Like, I would never suggest that he be called
no,
dad.
No, I just mean, like, but I mean, if that's something that evolved, I think, like, based on Bruce's character, I think he would be so resentful of that.
Well, here's where it would start. It wouldn't start with that. It would start with who's setting down guidelines and rules and expectations. Yeah.
Right, particularly as he becomes an adolescent.
Because if Bruce is still Master Wayne and still his boss in, like, a very, like, rich person way, like, how is he supposed to listen to Alfred? Like, who is the person in charge in this household? Because for him to be a secure, not a sociopath kid who's also dealing with all this grief, like, he needs the safety and security of someone setting down rules and expectations and being able and being comfortable to have follow through with consequences, you know, and to create a structure around him. If he needs to be hugged, does Alfred feel comfortable hugging him and, like, and having affection? And does Alfred, here's the thing. I don't understand how these dynamics work. So maybe servants and kids who grow up with servants are affectionate towards each other physically. I don't know how that works.
Well, I mean, they clearly are, at least in the moment of crisis.
But I mean, if you think of the movie The Help, like, those kids were really affectionate.
I just thought of a shit pie.
but, like, those kids are very affectionate. They have a very affectionate relationship, and I don't know if that's also because it's, like, women.
Well, they're nannies, too, aren't they?
They're housekeepers, for the most part. But back
then,
housekeepers did everything.
They're mostly housekeepers.
The housekeepers?
Yeah. Okay. They're mostly housekeepers, but end up taking care and raising the children because...
Mm-hmm.
The moms are sociopaths.
Well, because they're just... It's just the negligence of upper class.
Yeah.
And so, in this situation, I think, one, I'd have to get my head around... probably via Alfred, what their dynamic was prior to the parents dying.
Yeah.
How close were they already? Which I assume pretty close if the parents gave guardianship in their wills to Alfred, which is, I'm assuming, what happened.
Yes.
Then they probably already thought of Alfred as a good paternal figure for him and, like, a warm person who could take care of their son.
Oh, and also he's going to have this sense of duty that... is going to come from...
A good Irish butler would have? A good English butler?
Well, the English butler have it, also that a soldier would have.
Like, yeah,
a special forces soldier is going to have a special sense of duty and honor to a oath that he swore, and he, you know,
just
goes
loyalty.
Through, just loyalty.
Loyalty to the Wayne family, just in general, because he probably in some ways swore his allegiance to them somehow, if that's the kind of job he had. That's what I think about. I think about soldiers and
it's
stuff.
So dramatic.
That's how they are,
comic
though.
Comic book world.
Because what I would tell Alfred is that what'll help him out the most is one structure, which will come from having rules still, because he's probably going to test them. So you're probably going to have some conflict where he's going to fight against you being in charge now, especially with the added layer of you used to be my servant and you're also not my dad, so go fuck off. So it's going to be like a double,
right? There's, I mean, double blow. Teenage Bruce Wayne's so for sure going to do that.
Well, and like, and yeah, he's probably going to say, "So you're fired? Fine, I fucking fire you." I mean, like, how would so that argument there would not have happen? To
be, but that would be all stuff that, as their therapist, like working with both of them and Bruce, would be something I'd work through, like those kind of conflicts. Well, what happened there, and what did you need differently, and you know, supporting Alfred as a new parent in this role. Yeah. It's such a weird role.
Yeah.
But it also would have to, I don't think I could work with them unless there was an agreement that Alfred would be a parent. Because I don't even know how I would go about it if Bruce was still his boss. I'd be like, yeah, what are we doing then?
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to, I don't know how we would give this kid's feeling of safety of a parent, because kids want to be told what to do in a safe way. And if they are able to tell their parent what to do, then that leads to rebellion and feelings of unsafety and unloved, because being bossed around is a way to show kids you love them, because you want to keep them safe and you want to give them structure.
Absolutely.
And protect them. And so I think it would have to be, we'd have to make sure that it's a parental role and how, but it would be slow and steady. Like, it'd probably be first just rules and structure and keeping him fed and sleeping, the keeping routine and stuff like that. And then it would, I mean, they obviously are affectionate towards each other. Like we said, he's the most relaxed around Alfred. Alfred does have no problems confronting him and challenging him.
Oh, no, none.
Which suggests that there is a level of loyalty and affection,
yeah,
and love there.
That they, because both, you can only, that they both understand.
Because you can only really confront someone like that and be okay being confronted. Because Bruce never, like, wilds out on him. Like, they never have, like, a fight where he, like, they really, like, fall out. Because he kind of, I mean,
nope.
Alfred gets in his face and he accepts it for the most part. Like, he argues with him, but it's at, like, the end of the relationship. And that's a way that only really you can argue with people that you have a strong emotional connection with, where you can be that confrontive and work through it.
Yeah, I don't think they have any kind of major, huge fallout until the third movie, I don't think.
But it does seem like that thing where, but he isn't his dad. Like, he isn't a parent. Because even when he comes home from college, he calls him Master Wayne.
Right.
He's like, how has school been? But in a very detached way. And then he's like, you're not going back to school. And he doesn't really, like, challenge him on that, like you think a parent might.
Right.
Or even process through that, like a parent might. So there does seem to be distance.
Some distance.
Some, like, yeah, servant-based distance there. Like, he, right, Alfred still feels like very much the help. Like, the help that he's affectionate towards and loves, but still the help. And I think, going back to the show Gotham, if anyone's ever watched that.
Yeah,
that,
you see, I only watched there, like
the first,
sure,
season and a half, and then it got too off the rails for me. But
oh, they bring that it back. Show, it gets but way that, back tightened up.
I got too much TV to watch. But
oh, that's good.
That show does a good job of illustrating that the fucked upness of that dynamic. Because
oh, yeah,
they do have a lot of struggle where Alfred is trying to assert a parental role with him, and he does say things like fuck you, like not fuck you, but like you're fired, you're not my dad,
right,
you're
the, like, fucking 14-year-old Bruce.
Like,
yeah,
he's,
yeah,
confronting him a lot, because there is this weird thing that they're working through, which Alfred very clearly loves him and thinks of him like a son, but they have this weird valley between them of he's still a servant,
correct,
technically. And so you'd have to kind of abolish that.
Yep.
And what I would probably advise whoever's running this kid's trust or whatever, like, in order for them to have a healthy relationship, you probably need to give him not so much a salary as a stipend, and he just lives in the house, and he just, as if like an aunt was gonna take care of him, like an uncle. And you just
thinking,
you'd move into the, yeah, house, and maybe like you'd get money from like the family trust fund or whatever, the family estate, to take care of the kid, but you would be an independent person.
Right.
And I would say in order to do that, then they would have to hire another butler.
Oh, that's true. They need another,
like,
servant.
They would need a servant to do the servant-like things that they need in their giant palace home or whatever.
They probably just hire, like, a caretaker.
That's what I mean. And then so that Alfred would be free to be a caregiver.
Right.
To
I think
Bruce.
That's true.
I think that, that I would think probably true. That would probably be one of the biggest changes that they would have to make. Because I think that's where, like you pointed out so well, that's where that issue is that you can't have somebody who is, works for you, and also that you, who loves and supports you as a caregiver, would.
Right. Because there'd always be that doubt that they're just taking care of me because they're being paid to take care of me, and they're
and
not my
no
family.
Way, and there's no way to refute that when you're still acting like the butler. There's
still
no
still
way to
staff.
Get around that if you're still...
Which is probably why, even though Alfred is so sweet with him, and I love him, I think he is his saving grace in this movie in a lot of ways.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
He's so affectionate, and he does push him, and he is more loving and, like, sees through his bullshit and confronts him. But why he is still, though, so distant you know, is and kind of shut down emotionally because his closest relationship still has a lot of wacky dynamics about it.
Boundaries and dynamics that don't make any sense. Isn't
true.
Sense.
Could easily not feel like true intimacy.
I mean, I think that's true. I think that there's a lot that would need to change. So, Hannah, you think that they would need to hire somebody to replace Alfred's role as butler so that he could transition into more of the role of parent or guardian?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Just to reestablish the labels.
So what about your thoughts, Hannah? What do you think you would do if Bruce came into your office or the family unit here?
I mean, I think that it's kind of hard to say because Brittany already kind of talked about it, but I think that it would be, you know, if they came in, I think if they came in as adults, like maybe when he came back from college and he was maybe at a different point of really starting to feel some of the negative impact of his symptoms.
And also the point in your life when you're trying to date and have relationships, which exactly. can give you bigger buy-in later on in life.
Sure.
So maybe that would be a time where maybe I could see him coming in where he wants to have new other relationships with people and he does want to have friends and he is feeling lonely and isolated. Then he comes in and we kind of talk about, I would say we talk with him about feelings a lot probably initially and also just talk about the kinds of things he wants out of relationships. Go with that and have him come in with Alfred and say, this is an example of a relationship that you have. This mm-hmm. is what it looks like. What do you like about it? What would you like to be different? I mean, just trying to get him comfortable with exploring those things. I mean, I don't think that he doesn't have a choice in any of those things. He doesn't have the choice that Alfred is going to be the person who takes care of him.
No, he does not.
He doesn't have the choice in Rachel is the only other little girl, only other peer maybe that he had except for in school.
And even she was
the daughter of the help. So again, another situation where that's a complicated relationship.
Right, and assuming he even went to actual school and wasn't homeschooled.
I was going to say, yeah, because I don't even know.
I don't
He's
either.
Homeschooled.
I bet you he went to boarding school.
I don't think so.
I don't think he did, though, because like Alfred is the one who has been... So he's so isolated.
And then he's only hanging out with an adult.
Right.
Yeah, like,
regardless
of
being
a
servant.
He's hanging out with an adult. I mean, like, what things do you want to experience in a relationship? And I think that would be a way.
College would be a culture shock.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. I would be surprised that he would even go. And also, what for?
Yeah.
He's rich. And I mean, like, yes, for his own personal gain, right? To want to know how to run a business and to want to be able to do things, like, yes, of course. But also, like, for that much of a culture shock for someone at that state,
well,
like,
he didn't make it. He
right.
rebelled. He left.
He's done and he comes home. I mean, I think that makes Absolutely. A lot of sense that would happen. So I think he comes in after that and we kind of do a lot of psychoeducation, I feel like. It
oh,
would
yeah,
also
so
be
much.
A lot of just talking about relationships and what a healthy relationship is and helping him identify that and maybe even finding ways to make little changes with Alfred to help him feel more comfortable and feel more connected to him and let down some of those walls. I mean, I think it would be really, I think he would have to, you know, definitely do some trauma work before we even got to some of that stuff.
And it could be simple as just like what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, which is
yeah.
learning deep breathing and to
yeah finding ways
talk
to help
about,
calm himself down,
talk about your story,
right? Or, and acceptance and commitment could be helpful for him too, like learning how to you know, he says some of the things that are tenet, like the his, you know, it's what was it his I'm not it's not what I am but what I do, that kind of mentality, that kind of thing is what acceptance and commitment is all about. It's like learning to understand that you don't have to be what you used to be. You can accept rather than try to change everything.
Yeah.
You can accept it as it is and use it to propel yourself forward and deal with it rather than going through what CBT would encourage is like, okay, what are the dysfunctional thoughts and behaviors you're doing? How do you challenge that? How do you change that? This is like less of how do you change everything and more of how do you accept it and deal with it?
How do you find the parts that you want to keep,
right?
And the parts that you want to shift and get rid of and be able to let go or even just accept the things that that you can't.
Right, like I'm an irritable person sometimes and sometimes that's how I am, but like, how do I take that and make that mine and own it rather than like commit to changing parts of it that I don't like and using what of it I do like.
Do you think it would be interesting or prudent with him to do like play therapy stuff with him. Because he was and play therapy is exactly what it sounds like. It's therapy that looks like play. So it's like doing like things in like sandboxes, these little sandboxes. It's drawing, it's playing with toys, it's creating like family, like dollhouses and stuff like that. I guess where my thought came from that is he'd be young enough, like 21, where you could probably do it, and he still has a lot of youth in him. He was a kid when it happened, so bringing him back to his childlike self.
I was thinking about all of the things that he didn't experience as a kid, and wanting to help him work through some of that. And so it did pop up in my head when I was talking about treatment with him as doing something to help him kind of attach some positive identity to that part of himself, because probably his childhood is all rooted in the bats and his parents dying. And that there isn't anything else there.
Why he's so blunted now is he doesn't have any authentic playfulness, really, or childlikeness.
Yeah.
Which you do see in the other iterations of Batman that is very absent from Christian Bale's character, which makes total sense because even when he was a kid, he was fucking wearing tuxedos and going to the goddamn opera.
In most iterations of Batman, that's not there.
And being tutored at home, probably, like a little tiny prince.
Yeah.
So maybe helping him find that childlike part of him and immersing it into his current identity by doing childlike things. And clients get a little about doing that stuff because they'll feel silly, especially clients like him who are very not childlike.
Yeah.
But it can be a good way of finding that part of them and bringing some brightness into who they are.
Yeah, I think so.
And also just helping him experience those things to find those parts of himself that he does like, and those parts of the like things that he didn't get to experience and able to have that silliness and playfulness that he can have.
I don't see him going for it, but I think that if you could find a way to get engagement, that it would be great.
Could get him to draw or paint.
It wouldn't be my first thing. I mean, it'd be like after a while.
Right. I feel like this is where you also might crash with like rich kid like mentality of like, like, let's play, like, we don't do that.
Yeah.
I think people who grow up wealthy don't play, but, like, that the way you see him play, like, it would have to be maybe geist is more, like, art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, no, classical, no, that's, like, art, I know like, exactly, paint,
exactly art what therapy. You mean. I know exactly what you mean.
Art therapy or music therapy or
right.
something.
Yeah.
All right, so we've talked a lot about this movie. What are your thoughts? What are your final thoughts on this one?
I was surprised by how annoyed I was with his character, to be quite blunt. Because I think when this movie first came out, it was so different from any other superhero movie. Like, we only had, like, those shitty Fantastic Four movies. Sorry, Jessica Alba. And,
they're so bad.
And, like, the early Batman movies, which were also pretty silly. I mean, Tim Burton, even when his ones were good, but they were very silly. Like, satirical parodies kind of versions. Yeah. And so we never really had, like, a straight drama that was also a superhero movie. So it was so impressive at the time for having someone who's dark and more like a real person. And he is demonstrating realistic characteristics of someone who has been traumatized. So that all is very well done. But I think now that we've had more superhero movies and more superhero characters that are treated seriously and realistically, going back to this one, it didn't hit as good in my mind as it did when it first happened, just from the perspective now of having a wealth of these kind of movies. A Dark Knight definitely seemed a lot more sophisticated.
Oh yeah.
And a lot more money probably invested into it.
Oh, and undoubtedly.
And I think kind of what Hannah and I were saying, like, also looking now that we've had like the Tony Starks and the Captain Americas and seen all those stories being fleshed out in a really real way, and we've talked about them here, right. It is harder to watch a dude who has self-impose all this stuff on him versus someone who is just owning it, like Tony Stark, or had something happen to them, and so then they decide to use what they've been given for good.
Right.
Because it's so integral to who they are.
Sure. I think, for me, like, Dark Knight is the gold standard of superhero movies.
It is
and
the
you,
best.
You can fight me on that if you want to. Like, you can make, like, Infinity War was pretty goddamn good, but we'll see how that ends.
Dark Knight's probably the most sophisticated superhero movie that exists.
Absolutely. Like, you can make an argument for Cap 2 if you want. You can make an argument for Spider-Man 2, but I will fight you that Dark Knight is the best one. This one, however, I still enjoy it. I think that it's really good. It's well done, but it definitely feels like almost an indie version of a Batman movie where, like, they're trying to, like, flesh out this stuff. And it made for a really interesting concept that started a movement that made, that brought superheroes into a more realistic world. Yeah,
definitely.
World.
There wouldn't be Marvel, those Marvel movies we have now, if it wasn't for these Christopher Nolan movies. No. 100%.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Not.
I agree with that.
I enjoy this movie, like, as far as, like, this Dark Knight trilogy, like, this one is good and I enjoy it. Is it something I'd give an A+ to? No, probably like a B+. I enjoy it and I think it's got a lot of good themes and good messages, but overall, it's not my favorite, but I still think it's a great film and should definitely be enjoyed and will be enjoyed throughout time.
I will never watch this movie again. I like his version of Batman for sure, and I appreciate the change and the difference and what you guys said about it being one of the first movies that really took kind of superheroes more seriously and not of this kind of like really comic book character, right? Like goofy. It's you like really goofy and silly, and so I do appreciate that and the idea that this is one of the first ones that really made that shift. Okay, but I don't like the movie. I don't like Batman. I don't like this Batman that much in this movie, like, again, just in the vacuum of this movie. So that's it.
Okay. I have to say, like, the ending of that movie was one of the best, like, hook-ins, like, when they pulled that Joker card out.
Oh, that was pretty. I was like, ah! When I saw the Joker card. Because I would say what makes Dark... I mean,
that
not
kept
to,
me hooked for 3 years waiting for Dark Knight.
I love Christian Bale. I think he is a great, great actor. But yeah. I think what makes Dark Knight so great is that movie is not really about Batman. That movie's about Joker, and Heath Ledger kills it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But that's a whole nother discussion. So I feel like maybe we end here on our Joker card. That we had our first request ever was to do an episode just on the different iterations of Joker. And I will say...
Suicide Squad?
Definitely...
No.
We don't talk about that.
I vote
debatable.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah, agreed.
But... I'm going to drop our Joker card here that a Joker episode is coming when we haven't decided yet, but you guys have to know that for those of you who've been listening to us, Joker's coming, but from, you know, it's going to come and it'll happen and it'll be great because everything we do is great.
Well, on that note, you can find us. You can find
I said
us
I wouldn't say anything weird today, and I lied, so I decided I was doing a Trump impression.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Yeah.
Huge. So you can
it'll
find us
huge.
At Facebook. At Popcorn Psychology. You can find us at popcornpsychology@gmail.com if you ever want to contest what we've said today about Batman or have any fleshed out, like, different opinions. Or, you know, just praise us. And we also can find us at Instagram.
Now you're
at Popcorn Psychology. You can find us at Twitter at popcorn_psychol.
Just
right?
Psych, I think.
Just psych.
Popcorn_psych. Yep.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we're every 2 weeks, you know, come and check us out.